And welcome back, or welcome to the On Coaching Podcast. I'm Steve Magnus, joined as always by my good friend and colleague, John Marcus. John, what's going on, my man? That's why we're here. And guess what? If you want to make sure that John doesn't have to go into a jingle creating, you know, life to be able to support himself, guess what? You can help support this show and what we're doing by becoming part of the Running Scholar Program. And you know why today is one of the best days to do it, John?
Tell me, Steve. Drop some knowledge.
Well, because we've recently dropped the Igloi course, okay? Drop the Igloi course.
Oh my God, it's so good.
It's so good. And you know what? It's funny, I made a casual, like, hey, yeah, we're doing a course on Igloi, replying to someone on Twitter. And guess what? I had Mike Joyner, the physiologist extraordinaire, who was like on the forefront of saying, hey, here's what it would take to run a sub 2 hour marathon. And he predicted that like 20 something years ago, 30 years ago. Smart guy. And he's saying, hey, I want to look at this. Like, let me show this. And then I had it after that, Dave Epstein, sports gene, right?
Range, smart guy.
Smart guy.
He one of my former teammates, smart guy.
He messages and says, or he replies, hey, I want to look at that too. Why? Because smart people understand that Igloi was the coaching genius. And we've lost a little bit of that stuff that, like, hey, there's a lot of lost knowledge because he wasn't like Arthur Lydiard touring around the world giving lectures and writing, you know, 15 books that all say something similar. Igloi only wrote one book chapter in Hungarian, which we have, and then one article, again, another language, which we have. And that's why we are putting this out. In addition, I've talked to several former Igloi athletes. I put in a word, actually, as I got inspired, and I reached out to a couple others who I found, and I'm like, you know what? I'm just gonna keep going down this rabbit hole, even though the course is out, to add to it as we go, because that's what we're all about. This
is a labor of love. Yeah, it will constantly be updated. This is, for everyone listening, this is a Marius Bakken moment in early 2000. If you get on this and you understand what Igloi is doing, not just from a philosophical or methodology point of view, but also a scientific point of view, it literally changes the game, because it's not that anything's new. It's just now we better understand the metabolic biomechanism and also microbiology reactions that's happening. It is a Marius Bakken moment. Like, get on it. This is to your advantage. Like, Steve and I are already applying it with athletes we work with. I'm applying it at the high school level for like year two or three now. And it's just amazing how rapidly and effective it works with people. It's awesome.
Absolutely. I love that. It's a Marius Bakken moment. For those who don't know what that means, all that double threshold Norwegian style stuff you're seeing going crazy
in 2022, 2023.
guess where John and I were nerding out in, I don't know, 2004, 2005, on Marius Bakken's site, who was explaining exactly this.
Right. And no one knew about it. And here we're beating the drum. And like, seriously, it is going to be the best money well spent if you just sign up for the Scholar Program and just take the course and then consume nothing else, not even a part of the clubhouse, not even a part of anything else. Oh my goodness, you will be the better for it. This is how you level up. 100%.
And you know what? We're so confident that until the end of April, if you sign up, use the password Igloi FTW, Igloi
for the win, baby.
Use that, you get your first week free. You can try it out. Like, see what, go cram through all of it that's out there if you want. Like,
binge on it.
You know, binge. Yeah. See if you like it. And if you don't, you can get off. But I promise you, we're so confident that you're going to find value in this, that you're going to stick around for the whole course and go through it. So,
yeah, I mean, we might have to write a book on this, Steve, just on Igloi like this. This is the moment. Get on board if you're not already on board.
Yeah, there you go. Get on board. All right. So speaking of getting on board, we're going to talk about, I think, one of my favorite topics to talk about, which is do what works.
Yes, and don't do what doesn't work.
Yes.
It's very simple.
The very simple idea. Do what works. Don't do what doesn't work. This is going to be the high school and college track coaching edition. And we're going to kind of outline the basics or the things that actually impact performance, that actually impact how your athletes are going to be, and give you the ingredients to a good thriving program.
Yeah. Yeah. And the only way we can speak about this and we know about it is because we both coached at these levels and have had success and also have had a lot of failures. And, you know, that's the thing, right? When you first start getting coaching, you think, oh, I'm going to just be very, ingenious. I'm going to like break the mold. You know, it's kind of this Dunning-Kruger effect where you got a little bit of knowledge and think you're going to revolutionize everything. But the reality is, the revolution is in the application of doing the basics brilliantly and doing them well over and over and over again. And again, everyone makes this mistake early on. I made this mistake. Steve made this mistake. And it's something that if you just accept, when you understand what the basics are and you try to master and apply them, you get kind of that Mike Smith level of success. Like not a lot of frills, not a lot of fluff, nothing wild and fancy, just simple routine, basic habits that transfer someone from being someone that, you know, can be consistent in life, as Mike would say, consistent in training, and then someone that can be counted on race day. That really is the pathway that we're trying to achieve with this athlete population, who I call the academic athlete in high school and college.
So let's just start going through stuff, John.
All right.
I'll start with one that is actually not in the training realm, but I think is absolutely a basic for high school and college track coaching. Motivation and buy-in.
Oh, 100%.
If you don't have buy-in, you can have the best training program in the world. It can be the most scientific, the best thought out, something that is, you know, nearly guaranteed to get athletes faster, and it won't work. And the other side of this is, in people hate hearing this, but if you have a program that is kind of like not that great, but you have incredible buy-in, guess what? Athletes are going to get better. And we know this. We know this because, especially back in, you know, historically, you know, even going back to when John and I competed in high school, is a lot of crazy stuff works.
From a training standpoint, yeah.
And the reason I say that is often what happens is, and I'm sure you saw this on the college side too, is once in a while, even while I was coaching college athletes, you'd get a kid came in with some crazy high school coaching and you'd be like, that's weird. I don't know how that worked. But that kid got a lot better and faster. One reason, clean slate phenomenon. But the other reason is you talk to this kid, and often it was like, oh, I love my high school coach. Like, we had a great relationship. Like, I just trusted him or her 100%. And you're like, ah, this is why. Like, they were bought in. They said, this is like, I trust this person. We have this good relationship. And because of that, it allowed them to flourish.
Yeah, that the holy grail of buy-in is something we often talk about, but is mystified. And really, you know, it comes back to connection and as the genesis. And what is connection but relatability? So how we relate to one another. I'll give an example. You know, when I first started coaching high school, my relatability to the athlete was strictly in the performance sector. I'm here to make you fast or better or win races, because my background and my motivation was heavily, derived from performance. I cared a lot about the outcome, the results, the rankings, how I compared to other people. What I quickly realized being a coach was that was not a high motivator for a lot of athletes. Sure, a couple were motivated by that, but like generally as a whole, as a group, that was not the driving motivating factor. So what I found was I had to relate to people and get them to relate to the identity of being a track and field athlete, especially at the high school level and college level, where these academic athletes who are young are exploring different self-concepts and self-identities, right? So with that, it's like I just started to make coming to track practice more fun. And how did I do that? And I still do to this day. Bribe people with candy. Super simple at the high school level. Like, bribe them with candy. And it's not a bribe, but it's just like randomized, highly variable rewards here and there. So, you know, now we have different relatable things that kind of connects people to the team. So I'll give example with the high school group that I'm working with right now. We have T-shirt Tuesday. We're on T-shirt or on Tuesday, you wear your best T-shirt and the group co-decides who has the top three T-shirts on the day. Coach participates and then everyone gets a piece of candy who makes the top three. It's not that I'm deciding who has the best T-shirt. It's the group does, right? Then we have Fun Sock Wednesday, where it's just you wear fun socks. That's it. If you wear fun socks, you eat candy. It's for the whole track team. I go around and go, hey, you were wearing fun socks today. Here's candy. Here's candy. Here's candy. Right. And then we have Fast and Fun Fridays, where it's like that's our hardest workout of the week, typically for our athletes in my group in a non-meet week is Monday, Friday is our hardest workout days. And also you get a lot of retention problems, right? Typically on Mondays and Fridays, as anyone working in the high school level knows. So we give Fun and Fast Fridays, there's two things that we do. One is we have level up day, which is where we spend a lot of time on technique and I allow people to ascend to a different level, right? And we've talked about these levels before. We have basic, pro, boss level, and God level for how well we run with reactive running technique. And if you level up, no matter what, you get a big old king size candy bar on Monday. But if you just show up on Friday and you just do all the work and you do the workout with a smile on your face and you get it all done, you get a piece of candy no matter what. So it's the fact that like people know they will be rewarded in the moment or with immediacy for their efforts, but also with variability, like not knowing when the rewards will come, that gamification component keeps a lot of initial engagement and buy-in. Because as any high school coach knows, the first 2 or 3 weeks of high school track practice are the time when you're negotiating essentially with the athlete for their attention in a spring sport. Senioritis kicks in, nice weather kicks in, other, you know, other things are particularly on people's plates. They might go away and like not be consistent. So rather than create a strict, like, militant culture of like, you must be here, attendance is necessary, I try to create an environment where I want them to be there. And when they're not there, or if they have something come up, or they miss a day of practice, I just remind them very simply, hey, we missed you. I missed you. Where were you? Like, I really missed you. And that relatability of like, oh, coach noticed I was gone and coach cares, that starts to create that buy-in and relatability. And it works so, so well. And shout out to, again, my good friend and colleague and people we often reference on this podcast, Mike Smith, for showing me that because he is definitely a master of getting athletes to not only relate to each other, but relate to their identity as a contributor to a program's success.
Absolutely. And you know, one of the things that I like to do that, and something that I learned I had to learn kind of the hard way early on, is much like you, I took kind of a performance mindset of like, oh, I'm here to help these athletes perform better, and that's all that matters, and blah, 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 is I had to quickly learn that like often what mattered most was like what happened after practice, right? For the high school kids, you know, I remember for summer practice, like, you know, just sticking around and shooting the shit with these kids after they were done with their run, right? You're just sitting at the bench on the park. And that was often like where that kind of connection and trust came. And then on the college side, what I quickly learned is that having like an open door policy and having like ways and different manners where I almost like invited the athletes to just kind of hang out and sit around and shoot the shit. And if you go way back on my Instagram, you scroll back, you'll see all these pictures of like, I don't know, 10, 12 kids stuffed into a small little office. I mean, John was in my office and that wasn't like exaggerated. That would often happen because like I created a place where it's like, oh, okay, athletes, like after practice, we practice in the morning. Sometimes they have to wait around an hour or so before they head off to class, and they could go ride their bike back to their dorm or walk back to their dorm and then come back and to class or what happened. But when you create that space, then they take advantage of it and they're like, oh, this is the place to be. And what that does is it creates connection on a more human level. We're like, okay, I guess I can trust these people or this coach because like they don't just care about whether I run faster or not, but they care about me as a human being. And often what I found is that created, again, more buy-in where it's like, oh, these people will trust me in the coaching because they trust me in life.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's awesome. Like, yeah, Steve, seeing that in person, it really helped my coaching, especially at the college level as well, to create a hangout spot. Because really that's what we're talking about. It's like, where's the hangout spot? People are going to hang out somewhere, right? Now it's, you know, there's a digital hangout with all the various platforms on social media and what have you. Like we have the Discord Clubhouse server, which is a digital hangout, you know, for a lot of people who are scholars to connect and just kind of shoot the shit about, you know, different coaching problems, ideas, this and that. But physically, where's the hangout spot? And when I was a, you know, sub-elite, local elite, I should say, in the Northwest area athlete, and we had our club team, we had a collection of people on the team who lived in the same neighborhood a lot like you would have in a college campus. But we had this one person's place, which called the stoop. And the stoop was the hangout spot because that was where we all intersected to meet up for like the daily run or the long run or to run from basically where we live to the track, the public track that we used. And the only reason we call it the stoop was that meeting spot was it was, you know, the intersection that was kind of in close proximity to where everyone lived. But people would just kick it on the stoop, literally just kick it on the stoop. Like people kicked it in Steve's classroom, right? And when I was in a college coach, my office was a closet. So you really couldn't kick it in my office. A converted closet into an office. Like you think your office was small, Steve, like cut yours into like a fourth a size. That was my office. No windows, awful. So where was our kick it spot? Our kick it spot was actually the training room because the training room, they were a great staff. They cared a lot and they were really inclusive and inviting. And so people would literally just kick it in the training room and like pretend massage gun, pretend foam roll, like not really with a purpose in mind, just as going through the motions, but to dialogue and interact and exchange. And that creates that relatedness. Like in college coaching, I think what I figured out early, and I saw this from a good colleague of mine, was utilizing the bus ride back from a meet. And like just going up and down the aisle and checking in with athletes, not about and debriefing on their performance and talking about, did you like how you ran today or not? But like just getting to know them. Like some people are in study mode. Some people are in sleep mode. But some people are literally just in waste time and decompress mode. So it's like I would just plop down and have a conversation with athletes about things not related to track, things they liked. And that created a bond.
That's awesome. And I agree. I always felt like it's like that travel was a huge part of creating that bond, right? Because you had this, now you have this space where it's like everyone's kind of on the bus together or on the plane together or killing time together or what have you. And that creates that space. So 100%, I think that that's important. All right. So I know people are going to be listening and be like, okay, John, Steve, we get it. The buy-in, the motivation. Give me the training stuff that matters, what works. Yeah. So I'm going to start with something that I think is simple but misinterpreted often. And I think what works for high school coaching is important is I call it like nailing the extremes, which means we've got to do some sort of aerobic development. And notice I said aerobic development, okay? And we've got to have some sort of pure kind of speed power foundation. And I'm a big believer on this. And like, this is something that I recognized early on, didn't quite do perfectly, but recognized early on in my high school coaching career where I was like, you know what? We get a heck of a lot faster and probably 90% of the way there if we just build aerobically and then sprint up a hill very short was the thing that we did, was sprint up a very short hill. And that gets us, that sets the foundation for everything else we're doing. And I think I'm going to throw in one more wrinkle in here, is I think we overdo the middle part in high school. And it's we've talked about this in the past, but I think the reason we overdo the middle part is because that's the quickest way to progress, right? If we look at short-term progress, if I said, John, I need to get you really quick in 4 weeks, we'd probably do a lot of quote-unquote VO2 max type work, right? Or intense stuff, because we'd be like, oh shit, like John's not in great shape. Like we better just throw stuff at the wall and they'll get better. But what we forget is that, or what we neglect there is that quick progress is also stagnates very quickly. And that's where I think, again, focusing on the extremes, I was always kind of shocked and had to learn this lesson multiple times of like high school, you race all the time. And, you know, we'd come in that first cross country race, or in this case, that first, you know, January or February track meet in Houston, because we don't have indoors really for high school. And you'd be like, we haven't done much hard stuff. Like we're coming off of kind of easy, and sprinting is essentially what we were doing. And you'd have some kind of run the 2 mile and you'd be like, oh crap, you ran pretty dang fast. Or you're like, you PR'd. And you're just like, huh. But we forget that lesson. And then we think like, okay, I need to go back to the middle, hit it. But it's really that foundation of both sides of it that really work and make a big difference.
Yeah, I like that you highlighted that. A stronger athlete is a better athlete always. And unfortunately, right, the big barrier we have to overcome in modern society when we think about strength is we have been indoctrinated with this concept that strength is bodybuilding, and our strength training is bodybuilding. It's not, right? I equate bodybuilding to getting big and dumb. Strength training is getting smart and fast, right? So in order to be fast at something, you need to be smart. And what I mean by smart is the neuromuscular, you know, brain neuron muscle connection, or brain nerve muscle connection, needs to be really, really, really well honed and really well developed. So that's skill acquisition, right? So when we think about strength, we often think about, all right, we're going to get in the room and we're going to do bench press to get our pecs big. That's not how the body works. That is a really butchered concept of strength. So once we get past that barrier, we go, okay, what is strength? Strength has a skill component, and it has a technical component, and then it also has a fluency or speed component. And this is my argument for like why we need to focus a lot on strength for high school athletes and even college athletes. Because let's just do very simple math. We'll do Badger Mile math here, right? Let's say someone runs, 45 miles a week, right, at an average of 7 minute mile pace, okay? And let's say they take about 175 steps per minute, okay? And let's just say they run an average of 45 miles a week. We're talking about high school, junior, senior here potentially. And they do that for, on average, 52 weeks of the year. Doing that math, how many steps are they taking in that year from a training standpoint? The math comes out to be 2.9 million steps. 2.9 million. So they're going to do this highly repetitious thing, these steps, the stride, if you will, over and over and over again. And that's at a pretty modest interpretation, right? Obviously, it gets higher the more volume, quote unquote, you do. And we know that volume is a driver towards, adaptation and better training performance. So if I'm going to do millions upon millions of something in a year, why would I not spend time up front getting as good as possible at the technical proficiency of that, so that I can then be, then exploit the conditioning component? And this is what I think Steve, how I interpret what Steve said is, he says, we often overexploit the conditioning element, VO2 max, let's get them fast, let's do this, and not address their technical proficiency. So that's why wickets for runners, medicine ball circuits, hills, plyometrics, some weight room work that is geared towards strength, but not bodybuilding, is very advantageous for this athlete population and also college. But if we're just exploiting from day one, step one, metabolic conditioning, well, that's called Metcon and CrossFit. And essentially, we're no better than a CrossFit coach because we're just saying, oh, that's all that matters is the Metcon. And we have this bad habit in distance running to overemphasize that at the neglect of the strength, speed, skill, and technical development component.
Yeah, I mean, I really think of it as laying the foundation. And too often,
100%.
Too often we don't. And I think this is why, like you say, what works in high school, well, you know, part of the issue is it varies in the sense of what works for the athlete given their, you know, where they are and what they're trying to accomplish. And this is why, you know, one of the mistakes early on I actually did is I would take, you know, incoming new kids and you'd be like, oh, you're a freshman, like let's throw you into like the modified version of what everyone else did. And all you do is you scale it down, right? Where you're just like, okay, less volume, less intensity, blah, blah, blah. But it shouldn't be a scaled down. It's like, oh, what do you need to do to like build that foundation, right, off of that? And I think this is where if we think of high school to senior year and college or high school to senior and high school kids, it's like, how do we do that? Like, what do we do this? Even in the college side, what works is how do we, and I've used this example many a times, but I remember Brian Barraza coming in as a college freshman, running all out 800 in like 156 and me being like, yeah, this kid's talented, but like, this ain't going to cut it. So we're going to have to work on this, you know? And I think that's where you look at what works is also the things that allow you to get more growth in the future are often maybe the things that don't allow you to get more growth like quickly right now. And I think mm-hmm. if we zoom out and say what works versus what doesn't, I would add it's what works over the sustainable long haul for this athlete in their career.
Yeah. And yeah, I think having, you know, us having coached the whole spectrum, I remember being a high performance coach, you know, and Danny Mack and I being like, we're recruiting these college athletes to run post-collegiately. And we're like, oh my God, how have you gotten this far and this competitive and being so weak and discoordinated? Like he and I would sit and be like, it's going to take almost a whole year just to like get this person strong enough to be able to one, handle the rigors of the intensity of competing at the high performance level. And then two, being able to, you know, ward off injury and then be able to like handle the high level of severe racing. Because that's the thing about the higher up you go in the food chain of performance, the more severe the toll is of racing. It's not like racing at a high performance level is just as easy for, you know, a Josh Kerr as it is for my, you know, 430, 1500 meter freshman boy. It's like he recovers a lot quicker because the severity of the demand of running 430, even though they're relatively not as strong, is still relatively not as high. And that's something that we need to understand is like, are you passing them off potentially to the next level or the next chapter in their physical literacy and physical development in good shape with room to grow? Without that room to grow, right? Or if you've just exploited one track the whole way, someone's going to have to stop, you know, at the next level or levels down the road and go back. Like, you know, Danny and I have had to do and basically reset the foundation or address this foundation that was a total gap that is going to be, you know, a liability for that athlete in that next level.
And I think that actually brings us to something else that works, which is I call it, I mean, it's like the principle of gradual progress, right? Or gradual at stimulus and adaptation, or what I call like, take the next logical step. And I think if we look at from a training standpoint, too often we skip steps in high school and college. And what you're getting at is like that room to grow. How do we give that room to grow? Well, we create the foundation and then we don't get greedy. And I remember this as a high school coach thinking, and even on a college coach as well, but as a high school coach, I remember having Ryan Doner. His freshman year, I was like, oh, this kid's going to be pretty dang good. He'd already run pretty fast in junior high. Like, he was a very efficient runner, blah, 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 et cetera, et cetera. I said, I could get greedy and jump him up to whatever 70 miles a week right now and throw on all this stuff. But instead, we didn't. You know, instead, like, he gradually increased his mileage over those 4 years. He gradually increased his stress of workouts. If you looked at his workouts his freshman year, they were like ridiculously easy. You know, the quote unquote VO2 max workouts might have been like, I don't know, 4x800. Like, it, you know what I mean? Like, it wasn't much. We were just kind of building and letting his talent like flourish and take him through stuff so that he had that room to kind of grow. And then on the college side, I think it's very similar in the sense that it can be, you know, I called it the example I like to give is the 10K for college athletes. And a 10K in on the track for, you know, a high level athlete who's been training for a while, like, is, you can handle, it's not that big a deal. But the athletes John and I got often were not the super talented ones who came from like a, you know, big background of training or what have you. And I always, my kind of philosophy with those athletes was, I'm going to try and wait until your junior year or so to, you know, throw you in a 10K until you are ready for this, because I want it to be a positive experience. Even if you're showing as a freshman, like, oh, this kid's an aerobic monster, like, they're going to be a 10K athlete, I would wait until they were ready and could handle it and gradually grow that kind of process versus, you know, throw them into the deep end, even if we might have needed it. And it was the same with cross country. I know we're talking about track, but like, especially for men, is there were some athletes where you saw, you like, like, you might be able to help us your freshman year in cross country, but yeah, you're not ready for this, man. It's gonna like throw you for a loop and set you back. So we're gonna take this long-term view of like, hey, the next logical step is this. Maybe that's running unattached your freshman year in cross country and entering some 4 mile races or even 8Ks to get used to it, so that they're ready in the future.
Yeah, no, that's always the thing, right? As coaches, we have to have one foot in the present, but also, you know, an eye to the future. And like, I have that right now, right? I have a very young high school team, all mostly freshmen and sophomores, and or if they're older, they're first timers out to track. But I have some, you know, promising athletes who are like, ooh, you in a year or two, you're going to be just stone cold, you know, killer. But we have to not put that pressure on you now, because from a pressure or expectation standpoint, I can't tell you, hey, you're going to be there, because she's still developing her self-concept and gaining confidence and identity. But she has all the mental tools and buy-in and enthusiasm for the sport, good technique, a lot of consistency, all this stuff that I can see she can be a potential state champion and play that game if we develop her not just physically, but mentally and emotionally the right way. So I can't skip steps, as you say, and go, oh, hey, you could be on the podium this year in state, because last year you made it to state. And it's like, no, let's just see what happens. She's smiling, she's high active, you know, or this guy, it's like, oh man, you got a really good work ethic, but you haven't hit puberty yet. So wait until you hit puberty, and then all of a sudden you're going to get a lot faster just because, right? And I think, you know, Steve, that's where we, a younger version of me, the big failure was trying to have success right now and not playing a little bit of a longer game. And that longer game, that's really important. And the longer game means doing what works and sticking to the basics and doing the basics brilliantly. And you spoke about like the 10K in college, and for a lot of developmental athletes, you know, like, I came to a collegiate program where it's like, these kids had there was no history of the 10K, right? No history of, you know, competitiveness in the long stuff on the track. And yet we had multiple women qualified regionals in the 10K, which is a big win for us and our athlete population. We had a young man get like top 10 in the US juniors in the 10K on the track, right? It's like, how are all these people running these 10Ks now all of a sudden so well, who were just here, who were just sitting around. They're on the team before. They didn't do well in the 10K. It's pretty simple. The one workout we did week in and week out, and I have Jerry Schumacher to thank for exposing me to this, was the broken threshold 6x1 mile. That was it. It was not a rocket science workout. And we did that over and over and over again. And it was broken threshold 6x1 mile. And what we did was we first tried to anchor the pace at a stabilized pace. So for like the women, it'd be 6 flat. And then we just, you know, essentially microdose and reduced the relief interval in between the 6x1 mile. So it started off at like, say, 2 minutes, you know, for first week, and then a minute 45, and then, you know, 90 seconds, and then 75 seconds, and then 1 minute. And when it got to 1 minute, that's when it's like, we repeat the whole cycle over again. And now we reduce the rep pace from, say, 6 minutes to like 5:50, and we start back over. It is the most boring, simple thing in the world. But that one aerobic development workout coupled with pretty simple speed cut down ladder, 300, 200, 100, fast, fast, fast recovery, you know, relief interval, recovery interval is the distance of your next rep. Starting at the 300s at 800 pace, the 200s at 400 pace, the 100s as fast as you can go. I mean, and that's a different workout, but like those were staples that worked so well and still work well to this day. Because again, it's just the right amount of dosage with the right routine and frequency, and we don't have to be so worried about chasing such drastically novel stimuli where it's like, oh, I heard about this workout. Let's do this. I heard about this workout. Oh, CV. Oh, you know, this, da, 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 da. It's like, get the stable gains. If we get the stable gains, that goes a long way.
Exactly. And it really is in those couple staple things. You know, I remember back in my high school career, and then I used the same thing, when I was coaching high school initially, is my high school coach at this local park, he made this 5 mile loop at the park that went up every hill in the course and in the park. And so we had, you know, 800 meter long gradual hill. We had a 600 meter long hill. We had a 300 meter sand hill, and you'd basically go around and around. And the brilliant thing about this 5 mile loop is there were zero like measurements within the course. So you had no idea where the mile marker was, the 2 mile, the 800, whatever it is. It's just like you're making turns randomly throughout. And I love this because my high school coach essentially did this. He's like, you know what? In the summer, the beginning, we're just going to run this steady. And maybe you'd run it at like 6 minute pace or a little bit faster. And then throughout the season, both in cross country and track, as the weather kind of cooperated more, it became more of, okay, let's run a little bit faster. Let's see what we could do. And by the end, you know, I'm running low, mid 25s in it as kind of the tempo, right? For me, for others, we're running 26, 27, 28. But I love that idea of like, here's this basic staple workout where it's like, this is our kind of aerobic development marker of where we kind of are in comparison to that 6x1 mile. And it was all by feel because you had no freaking clue like how fast you were running. And the other thing is your pace varied because sometimes, let me tell you, if they dumped a bunch of sand on the sand hill, which they did every once in a while, like your pace would slow dramatically, but it wasn't a big deal because like you were just adjusting and being like, well, if I want to make it through the sand hill at 2.5 miles, I'm going to have to kind of like trudge up this thing and then gradually get back into this aerobic pace at some point. But it was like this kind of staple of like, this is how we develop aerobically and we're going to get better and all that stuff. And on the flip side, similarly, like I remember my high school coach, and I kept this for high school and college kids, is he'd be like, you know, during those periods, he'd be like, all right, we're going to go to the track and we're just going to run 200s. And it would start off as rhythm, right? He'd be like, all right, we're going to start off and just run these 200s at like 3K or mile pace rhythm. And then the last couple, he'd be like, yeah, just start cranking if you feel good. And what happened for me is I'd start off at like 31. And then my last one would be, you know, 26, 25 point, something like that. And you'd walk away. And I don't know, sometimes you do 8, sometimes you do 10, sometimes you do 12, sometimes more, whatever it is. But I remember you'd walk away, A, feeling the rhythm and locking into what it feels fast, and then doing what I call feel good finish fast, where you're like, yeah, you're a little tired, but you're like excited because you're just like, great, I just finished number 8 at 25. And like, because we only did 8 200, it's not that tired. You're not that fatigued, but you get energized off of it. And you've got that other kind of extreme of learning how to run fast without pressing, right? And I think, again, if we look at those basics, I promise you, you could run really freaking fast if all you did was some sort of, again, that 5 mile course, John 6 by mile, and then did some 200s, varying the pace from mile all the way down to, you know, kind of 400-ish pace. If you did that, you would run very quickly in high school. And I think that's where we, again, we come back to what are those basics, is we get seduced by the fancy workouts of like, oh, can you run 4 by mile in 440 pace, like cranking it or whatever it is? That means you're ready for the 5K. And yes, in some instances, like those can benefit and we can do those and like they prepare us. But I think that those workouts that are kind of the sexy direct, you know, workouts that translate, are that like we fall in love with them because they give us some security of like, oh, now I'm ready to go, right? Because I've run mile repeats at 5K pace or what have you. When the reality is, a lot of times that is, we're just doing that to prove to either ourselves as athletes or coaches. And the reality is that is the icing on the cake.
Yeah. No, it's, yeah, a lot of times, like, to ease our discomfort or ease our insecurity, we do these performance indicator workouts, right? Like, people always ask, what's a good performance indicator workout? And I go, well, you know, the best, like, say for the 10K, for example, like, you know, I had this conversation with, you know, Jerry Schumacher when I was trying to figure out how to train 10K runners, because I was pretty good at training middle distance, but I didn't know really that well how to do 5K and 10K. And I was like, Jerry, why don't you do with these guys, you know, the Bowerman athletes at the time, like 6 by a mile at 5:30 or 4:30 with, you know, 3 minutes recovery or a lap jog, like say Alberto does. And he goes, John, it's not about the one workout. It's about stacking workout after workout after workout. I go, if these guys can do 5 or 8 by a mile at 5 flat with 60 seconds rest on the grass, week in and week out, and have it not be that big of a disturbance or big of a stress, that's the indicating workout, those stacked workouts, right? And so that's where I think sometimes we forget that's what led me down that path to be like, oh, just do 6 by a mile steadily and consistently, make it just a little tougher by just giving a little less rest every revisitation of it. And then all of a sudden good things will happen. And, you know, it's this idea of what works, right? And everyone talks about it. And this is the biggest, most, you know, I feel misinterpreted concept out there, is consistency. But what is consistency really about? To me, consistency is really about routine. And really what routine's about is about habit. And you see all the greats do this. So, you know, Rob Connor, very consistent, very routinized with his training schedule, week in and week out. It's the same time, same place, same day, typically sometimes the same venue, week in, week out. Mike Smith, his training schedule, very routine, very consistent, week in and week out. Alan Webb's a really good example. When Alan was doing really well, you know, because he, as a professional, because remember, he wasn't in a college scene for that long, there was routine. There was a lot of routine. When Alan Webb started to, like, you know, kind of get a little distracted from his routine for a variety of reasons, moving to different cities, changing coaches, you name it, that's when a lot of, you know, performance started to deteriorate for him. And you, I mean, reading his training logs, you see it. When he was 2006 to 2007, that epic year, you look at his training log and you can just tell this man was just like living like a clock, right? Jumbo Elliott's concept of living like a clock. So the goal is to build in the routine. And by building in the routine, you build in the expectation, you build in the opportunity for athletes to be consistent. So now, like, we have, if you come to my high school practices, very, very boring from a training X's and O's standpoint. We're going to do the same general warm-up with the team every day. We're going to do the same specific warm-up with agility ladder and wickets. The goal with wickets, right, is not to run them faster, not to run wickets longer. It's to stabilize through the 40-meter run out after the wickets, same type of technical proficiency you have in the wicket without the wicket. And that's 300 meters of attempting to try to stabilize technical proficiency every day. Do that math, 300 meters times 5 days a week. That's a mile's worth of, you know, technical proficiency, mastery, practice over the course of, you know, 12 weeks. Well, you got 12 miles of technical proficiency practice built in. And there's no way you're not going to get better as long as I emphasize the import of having and sustaining that technical mastery outside. And then we have three basic running drills we do: the 100 meter drill, the 200 meter drill, the 400 meter drill. That's it. Every workout is a variation of those metabolic drills. And then we have two essential speed workouts we do. We have the speed endurance workout, which is fast, faster, fastest with very, very razor thin recovery. And then we have the classic cut down workout, which can be 300 meter cut down, 200, 100, 200, sorry, I got 200, 150, 100, 50. And then finally, pure speed. Just I let the athletes choose. I say, all right, athletes, today I'm thinking of a number between this and that, and they'll choose a number, or I'll say, hey, how far do you guys want to sprint today? Between 40 and 80 meters. Some days will be 50 meters. Some days will be 70 meters. Whatever it is, that's what we go with, right? And we always do seven sets or seven reps. That's it. It's not rocket science, but we have the same type of things on the menu on similar days. Like Monday is going to be pure speed and some metabolic flux work. Tuesday is going to be some speed endurance work. Wednesday is going to be do something different, take a day off. Thursday is going to be the 200 meter drill and med ball circuit stuff. 400 or Friday's 400 meter drill. That's in a non-race week, right? It's very predictable, but you know what? They get a lot better, a lot faster. The gains are stable and the gains are rapid because we're consistent, because we have a routine, because we have these habits.
Yeah, I think it matters a lot. And I think that's where we get kind of the basics. And again, I'm going to go back to something that I did in high school and then kept going, is like my high school coach came from a sprinting background. I mean, my sophomore year, he took over the cross country team, and that was after like 25 years of coaching the sprints. and I remember my freshman year as a sprint coach, and he coached a guy who ran fully automatic when legal 10.28 in high school, which was really fast, you know? So, and then he took over the cross country team, and you're sitting there like, what? And we ran a lot of volume in high school. But the other thing, looking back in my logs, that is quite clear is we also did things like 5 times 100 meter with running like flying start. And in my log, it's listed as like 12.2 down to 11.5. And that's sprinting, right? That's quick. But you see those basic things where it's like, oh, like this is to develop that other side of that spectrum that we often neglect as distance kids. And I would do that with my college athletes as well, because I knew, hey, we're getting that neglected. And you know, often I would start with hill sprints, but then eventually transition to things on the track where you're like, okay, how do we learn how to run fast and put force into the ground while not straining? And it is a skill to develop. And the quicker you develop those, or the more you can develop that skill, the kind of better off you go. I like it. I like to look at, and Gareth Samford has some great work on this, but if you think of it as like kink in the pipes along the way, right? And if we have like, what can we run in a 60 meter dash? And then, well, what's our 400? Well, what's our 800? What's our 1500, our 10K, whatever going up? Is that often what you see if you can measure all this stuff. And every once in a while we do this, but one of my favorite things to do was it for college athletes was to have them run 100. We'd run a couple hundreds basically all out, right? In practice, full rest, you'd get a time for them. And then you'd throw them in a 4x4 and you'd see the difference, right? And some people, like, you could see it's like, oh, you're pretty much getting the max out of like your speed and speed endurance here. And other people, you'd be like, what the heck, man? Like, there's like, you can, you know, you can run X for 100, but you only run Y for 400, or vice versa. Sometimes it's like, wait a minute, you just split 50 point, but when we sprint, you look like, you know, you struggle, and you're like, oh, you're struggling because you can't start, you can't put force into it. And you might say, well, distance runner, what does that matter? And it's like, it's a coordination thing. So if I can't start, if my 100 sucks because like it takes me 50 meters to get coordinated, well, that tells me that athletically I don't have a good foundation of coordination. So I need to develop that. Not that like, oh, I need to run a faster 100, blah, blah, blah. But it's the coordination that is getting expressed where you don't see that performance versus maybe in the 400, or if you tested them over 300, right? They're pretty dang quick and fast and have some good speed endurance, but it just, they suck getting into that. So you're looking for these kinks in the pipes along the way to understand, again, to give them this longer foundation. And the same goes with the opposite side of, you know, the endurance. While I'm on my soapbox, is, you know, sometimes you'd see athletes who, for example, could do the John 6x1 mile or the Jerry 6x1 mile threshold, but then when we threw them on that 5 mile hill course, they would suck. And you'd be like, wait a minute, you can do 6x1 mile and be in control. And then you realize, oh, it's because they don't have a break, and we've introduced a little bit of fluctuation that gets us out of that aerobic because you have to run up a sand hill for 300 meters. And you're like, oh, they are aerobically strong, but any sort of variation outside of that like sends them over the edge and like they can't recover. What do you do after that? You say, you know what? I need to do some flux training, essentially. So that's, you know, stepping off my soapbox, is that's where we're looking at these foundational components that allow us to kind of have a bigger, better picture of like, oh, where's your kink in the pipe? Where are the things that are preventing you from growing and developing as an athlete in the future?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good call, Steve. Yeah, one thing, you know, I think that's key with, you know, the concept of doing what works and not doing what doesn't work is, you know, I know you said this in Science Running, and I know this is like a big thing, you know, you say always be adding, and Canova says that too, but I would refine that to, we should subtract as much as possible, and instead of thinking about adding and creating clutter in the program, we should think about refinement. And so when we add something, we really have to ask ourselves, is this going to, what's the cost benefit analysis here? What's the return on investment? Is we only can have so much in the program before it becomes a bucket list of things to check off, and the athlete's time and attention becomes so distracted. And at different levels, specifically here in high school and then also college, you do have to be okay with leaving things off, you know, off the table. So things that are on the table for like my program, right, in the high school level at the moment are long runs. We don't do them. You know, we don't have enough time to get in the weight room and do, you know, kettlebell work and traditional strength training that is barbell associated, trap bar deadlifts. We just don't have the time. But we do have, you know, one thing we made a big investment and spend in as a program was we got brand new medicine balls, brand new plyo, soft plyo boxes, 6 inches and 12 inches, because those are immediately accessible at the track and we can just walk over and get those out of the track shed and then do them right there and there as a cool down. But in order to get to the weight room, that requires a 8-minute walk from the track to the weight room on campus. And that's just too long for the very concise period of time that I have to work with these athletes. It's unfortunate, but it is what it is.
You know, I love that example because it reminds me of a conversation I had with the strength coach extraordinaire, Dan John, years ago, which he said, you know what? Like, one of the best things if I was a track coach is I would take the weight room essentially and put it next to the track. Meaning for him, that means like bring out a kettlebell or whatever it is that you can put right there, because what you're doing is you're like minimizing that time component and making it, his point was also in especially for the female athletes, is like give them an environment where they're comfortable in and they can see this connecting to other stuff versus throwing them in the weight room where they might not be. But I think that I love that idea of like refining in your program of what are the things that actually make a difference versus trying to jam it all in. And I think that's what Canova is getting at and I'm getting at adding stuff is adding stuff that like makes the difference and works. And the stuff that doesn't is like, don't do it. And I think the other part of it is too, is I was really conscious of this in college, is you have to realize that they're more than just athletes out there and they're not professionals running around. So my goal was, especially when we were meeting in the mornings, is, you know, my goal was to be as efficient use of our time as possible, because like, yeah, we could have woken up at 5:30 a.m. and started practice at 6 and had 2 hours to do stuff. But then I'm impacting their recovery and their sleep and all that stuff. So my goal was, how do I create workouts that, you know, essentially start at 7 or 7:30 and get us done by, you know, 8:30, 8:40 at the latest. So you're looking at an hour, hour and a half, depending on when you start, and like be really efficient. So if you look at even the stuff like the warm up for the athletes in the mornings, it wasn't the Alan Webb style warm up that I did when I trained with Alan, where you'd go through this elaborate thing. And I think that has a place and stuff, but given the constraints we had, it was like that was not the place for all the drills, all the stuff. Our goal was like efficient, get warmed up, get ready to go fast in a safe way so that we can like maximize our time in this period. And I think you just have to understand, like anything, there are trade-offs at the high school and college level, and you have to make those appropriately.
I love that you said that. That was the point I was going to make to kind of finish up. Our inventory on this podcast was, you know, what doesn't work? Optimization. It doesn't work. You can't fit everything in. You can't do everything. I made that mistake for a long time, believing there was, you know, the holy grail of optimal and optimizing everything. It drives you literally insane because you read all these articles, you hear these podcasts, read these books, and it's like optimize, optimize, optimize. And I still, you know, encounter a lot of athletes, especially in the post-collegiate athletes I work with, who have the optimization mindset. And really, it's why I've gone, you know, and try to backtrack them or reorient them towards the good enough mindset. And that the good enough mindset is essentially that it's about accepting the realities of the environment you're in and accepting the trade-offs, because that's the key. Good enough means dealing with the constraints of the environment and the athlete's reality so that you don't infringe on everything because you just try to optimize in this one silo. And that is exactly what we're talked about with high school and college. They have a lot of things on their plate, as most people do. So if you come in with an optimization mentality, like, all right, we need to have nutrition at this time, we need to have sleep at this time, you need to be, it becomes kind of almost like a rigid Nazi type program, where, yeah, there's routine and consistency, but if it creates fragility, because the athlete then feels like, I have to check all these boxes throughout the day. And if I don't, if I miss one box or two box, oh, woe is me, I've messed up the whole process. And it's like, no, just refine on the big rocks that you have control over, get those really robust as possible, and accept you're not going to optimize everything. Be on the lookout for the key things that do matter, right? Is the athlete, you know, at the high school or college level and high school level, staying up way too late? That's a big conversation to have, you know, about sleep hygiene habits. At the college level, how much alcohol are they having week in and week out? That is a huge disruptor to sleep. The more alcohol you have, the more frequent you have it, the more consolidated period of time you have it, the more it is a disruption to your homeostatic well-being and a potential to recover. You know, the general nutrition, you know, talk where it doesn't become a phobia, but it becomes something to enjoy, but also something as a tool to help augment, you know, adaptation. Those are like the big general things to talk about, right? Not worrying about, did I run 75 miles this week or 65 miles? That's just a non-qualifier in my book, because you're trying to now get in this optimization mindset of something really specific. that only works if those big, 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 big rocks are really, really solid. And again, we go back to how did Luis Guevara get fourth in the world? What did Mike Smith attribute it to? Luis just went to bed at the same time 100 weeks in a row, 2 years. He really just boils it down to that being that freaking simple. And you know what? It's probably true. It's probably true.
Love it. I mean, that's very true. But that's, I think you're spot on there is, you know, nail the freaking basics. Do them brilliantly. And if you do that,
right,
good stuff is going to happen. Well, we thank you, everybody, for listening. As always, check out the Igloi course, the Running Scholar Program. Join our monthly.
Oh, my goodness. Meetings. Yes, please do it. Please. Yeah. Even if it's just for a week.
Yeah.
Please.
Remember, Igloi FTW for the win. You get a free week. So check that out. And we're going to be bringing you what works and what doesn't as a semi-regular piece on this podcast. So if you
semi-regular installment, yeah,
if you enjoy this, just wait, more of it's coming. Thanks everybody for listening.
Yeah, yes, semi-regular installment, yeah.